loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Just for our listeners, before we introduce today's show, we are taking a break. Loud and Clear is taking a one-week vacation starting Monday. We'll be back again the week from this coming Monday, so tune back in when we're back. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. Ahead of the anniversary of the deadly Charlottesville white supremacist protest, we'll speak with Dr. Alice Bonner about a pivotal moment in the fight against racism and for justice in the United States, the Watts Uprising of 1965. Amazing history, untold. Stay tuned to Alice Bonner. And then again today, we take a look at the political races around the country in the run-up to the midterm elections in November. We do this every Friday.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam has declared a state of emergency in Charlottesville in advance of the one-year anniversary of the violent Unite the Right rally. Last year, a right-wing extremist ran over and killed 32-year-old Heather Heyer. This year, authorities are preparing for the worst. Next, President Trump's new Space Force will be the first new military branch since the creation of the Air Force 70 years ago, if Congress approves it and it can get off the ground. But what exactly is a Space Force, and do we really need one? Then, Fusion GPS founder Glenn Simpson met secretly with one of Barack Obama's senior-most Justice Department officials, Bruce Orr, immediately after the 2016 election, according to Orr's handwritten notes that were released yesterday. In that meeting, Simpson told Orr that Trump attorney Michael Cohen was the secret middleman between the campaign and the Russian government. Simpson admitted in sworn testimony last year to the House Intelligence Committee that he had contact with Orr after Trump's election victory, but Orr's notes provide the first detailed public account of what the two men actually discussed. We'll get into the details. And then the National Security Archive, a private academic organization at George Washington University that is the repository for declassified government documents, announced today that its Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the CIA for documents related to the agency's director, Gina Haspel's, involvement in the torture program, was successful. The archives already have released those documents, and they are damning in the information they provide on Haspel and torture. And finally, Code Pink is one of the most active and influential peace organizations in America, tackling issues from Gaza to immigration to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the leading members of that group is our friend and frequent guest, Anne Wright. Earlier this week, Anne found herself at the U.S.-Mexico border, where she's been working to improve the plight of so many immigrants to this country. And in other headlines, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for an independent investigation into an airstrike carried out by the Saudi-led coalition fighting in Yemen. The airstrike hit a school bus, killing dozens of children. Guterres issued a statement demanding that the coalition, quote, respect their obligations under international humanitarian law, in particular the fundamental rules of distinction, proportionality, and precautions in attack, unquote. President Donald Trump today reignited the debate over NFL players' protests against racism and police brutality during the national anthem. Trump tweeted, quote, be happy, be cool. A football game that fans are paying so much money to watch and enjoy is no place to protest, unquote. Protests already have taken place at this year's preseason games. The first public debate in Brazil's closely watched presidential election took place last night. Former President Lula, who is the most popular politician in the country according to opinion polls, was unable to participate due to his incarceration, which was a top subject of discussion. During the debate, far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro was repeatedly criticized by the other candidates. A fierce Taliban offensive is underway against the Afghan city of Ghazni, the capital of the province of the same name. The Taliban claims to have taken over most of the city, but Afghan government officials deny this. Last year, the Trump administration sent several thousand additional U.S. troops to Afghanistan, prolonging a war that began nearly 17 years ago. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our special ongoing intermittent series with Dr. Alice Bonner, where we talk about key important episodes in Black American history. Dr. Alice Bonner joins us in the studio. She is a volunteer docent at the newly opened National Museum of African American History and Culture. She is a retired professor at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland, and she is a longtime journalist at the Washington Post. She wrote her dissertation on the history of press desegregation. Alice Bonner, welcome back.
Thank you.
Dr. Bonner, tomorrow, August 11th, is the beginning of the Watts Uprising, or insurrection, or what's known in American vernacular as the Watts Riot. But let's call it an uprising or a rebellion. Its impact on the United States, its impact on the Johnson administration was profound, and especially President Lyndon Baines Johnson, who had just signed the hard-won Voting Rights Act of 1965. It went on for nearly a week, a real turning point in modern American history, right?
Absolutely. And although there have been stunning disturbances or uprisings in such communities since then, Watts still stands alone because it was new. It was a new phenomenon. And as Dr. Gerald Horn said in his book about that incident, that week-long continuation of violence and anger in Los Angeles, he said that this was an unprecedented and significant incident, not only for African Americans, for Black America, but it came out of the civil rights movement. It was a turning point because the civil rights movement had always aimed to be nonviolent. And people across the country watched as the violence that occurred in from 1955 until 1965, 55 being the year of the beginning of Rosa Parks' decision not to go along with the racist transportation issues or rules in her hometown of Montgomery. From 55 to 65, in spite of the violence against the people who were protesting for their constitutional rights, the protesters had been largely peaceful, and Dr. King, of course, insisted on that, as did many of his aides, such as Bayard Rustin. Well, in Watts, the people who participated in this six plus days of protest were not peaceful, and they had been subjected to watching the anti-civil rights violence by segregationists on television for a long, long time. They were not there in the old Confederacy and had largely escaped some of the worst of the rules that kept them in second-class places. But they hadn't felt either as beneficiaries of the changes that had been brought about over those 10 years, nor had they felt firsthand the anger that propelled them to the streets. They hadn't come to that place.
Dr. Alice Bonner is our guest. She's joining us here in studio. We're talking about key important episodes in the history of Black America. Today, of course, on the anniversary, we're focusing on the 1965 Watts Uprising. Watts is, of course, not in the South. It's in the southern part of California. It's in Los Angeles. It's in South Central Los Angeles. After World War II, John, 500,000 African American people migrated, mainly from the South, to Los Angeles, hoping to escape the South.
In fact, that was the question that I wanted to ask Dr. Bonner. We're not talking about Birmingham. We're not talking about Memphis or Atlanta. We're talking about Los Angeles. So what did it mean to be Black in Los Angeles at that period? Why was it Los Angeles that exploded the way it did?
In a word, television. When some of the people in the streets tried to explain to television news reporters why they were so angry, why they were burning their own neighborhoods, actually, and the commercial establishments that weren't really theirs but were there for them to shop in, they said, we were invisible. We just got tired of being invisible. This population had grown somewhat rapidly because the exodus out of the South, largely to California, had been fueled by the need for armament industry workers. And California had lured these people away from desperate situations, and they made good money as long as that went on during the war. But after the war, they were left with very little to do by way of employment, very little way of upward mobility, and severe redlining. You could have all the money in the world, as Nat King Cole's biography attests, and there were neighborhoods you were not allowed to buy a house in. In fact, they developed an accommodation for it. There were a lot of real estate people in L.A. who would purchase a house for you, and you could get around the covenants that way.
That's the redlining. Black people just were not allowed to live in white neighborhoods because banks wouldn't extend credit. Real estate developers were part of it. South Central L.A., a vast, sprawling area. You know, if you come from New York City, you're used to kind of high-rise poverty, but this is low. I mean, it's there's not high-rises in South Central, and it just goes on and on and on. Again, just for our audience that maybe wasn't born in 1965, which is probably a vast part of our audience, or too young at that time, this uprising that took place in Los Angeles included as many as 30,000 people. It was not a small event. There, we had 14,000 National Guard troops were dispatched to patrol the streets. There was a lot of violence. And as you're talking about, or we haven't mentioned yet, 34 people were killed during the rebellion. Many were killed by the National Guard. Many were killed by the police. And as happened in Watts, the triggering event, and it happened the year before in Harlem. It happened the year before where I came from, Rochester, New York, which was one of the first rebellions in Black America, again, a northern city where Frederick Douglass was and Susan B. Anthony as a center of progressivism. It was the police. It was a police event. And I'm looking, Dr. Bonner, it's a website called blackpast.org. I want to just read a sentence or two about how this all began. The rebellion began on August 11th when the Los Angeles Highway Patrol stopped Black Watts resident Marquette Fry and his brother, alleging that they were speeding. Backup was called from the Los Angeles Police Department, LAPD, notoriously racist, as a crowd of African Americans gathered to watch the scene. Since the incident was close to Fry's home, his mother emerged to find her son resisting arrest. Fearful that his arrest may ignite a riot, one LAPD officer drew his firearm. Catching a glimpse of the gun, Mrs. Fry jumped onto the officer's back, causing the crowd to begin cheering. And then the police vehicles left the area because the masses of people had come out. They were cheering the fact that this mother had successfully intervened to stop what might have been the police murder of her son. That's how it all started. It's amazing.
It's really interesting that so much of this history in general, you have to go to literature to find it. And if there is anybody who is a fan of Walter Mosley, I haven't ever read any writer who captures the mood and the tone of living Black in Los Angeles in this period better than he does in some of his novels, such as Black Betty, and the police interaction and how they took it upon themselves to keep people in their place, which was a Southern phenomenon, generally speaking. Or it was of Southern origin after the Civil War. But they had methods, and even the Black police officers, few as they were in the 1960s, became a part of this. And so nothing has surpassed it in the area that was affected. The area that ended up getting burned out was larger than San Francisco. It was larger than Manhattan. It was studied in great depth, and it turns out that the McCone Commission, which then Governor Pat Brown, who was the longtime governor and father of the current outgoing governor, he set up this McCone Commission. John McCone had been the head of the CIA, and they studied this thing and gave back a report that showed this could have happened at any time on any given day, but it was really hot. Air conditioning was not something known in Watts or in ghettos, to use the term of the time, of that kind, and people were outdoors. And the word went through the crowd like lightning that a pregnant woman had been beaten by the police there on that corner of Normandy Avenue. And so the rage began then. It didn't immediately turn to looting, but of course that's a natural outcome because the McCone Commission found that the great official mistake was that the cops pulled back. When the cops left, thinking that that would quell the crowd, quell their anger, then it really got bad, and that's when people started to scatter beyond the immediate area.
I wonder about that, though, because, you know, it's kind of after the fact. The police withdrew, and then things got out of control. But if the police had been engaged, they would have been engaged by shooting people.
That's right, and the death toll probably would have been much greater than it
I mean, that's what happened in Newark in 1967, sure. 2 years later. It happened in Harlem. Because the police really don't have the capacity to quell.
And more so then than now.
Yeah, and the mm-hmm. police were, I mean, we could fast forward to 1992. Again, South mm-hmm. Central Los mm-hmm. Angeles, after Rodney King was beaten up and it was captured on video, which back then, that was rare. You know, now we have all these videotapes, but Rodney King was a motorist. He was beaten, like those nine cops were just wailing on him with batons, and somebody got a video of it. And it was when the police were acquitted, when they were found not guilty, when it's obvious, you just have to watch the videotape. It goes on and on and on where he's being beaten nearly to death. I was surprised that he was still alive at the end of that. And when he was acquitted, Los Angeles rose up once again. That was, you know, that was 27 years later after Watts. In other words, the police are in many ways the abrasive element in it.
That is true. And a study in the opposite of that is 1968 here in Washington, D.C., when then Mayor Walter Washington, after the National Guard was called out in the wake of Martin Luther King's assassination, Mayor Washington said, "We are not going to have you shooting people over television sets." And so they were there in the areas that were being destroyed, that were being becoming central to the uprising, but they didn't have the authority to shoot at will, as in some other places, and it turned out to be far less deadly, the police actions did, and I think it also shortened the length of the protest.
That's so important, Dr. Bonner. You know, I can remember vividly. I can remember Watts because I was 12 years old at the time, almost 13. It was, you know, it dominated the news at the time. I can remember even more vividly, maybe because I was a little bit older in 1967. It was the front page of Life magazine. It was a picture of a National Guardsman with a rifle pointing at the back of a young black teenager who was fleeing. And he had probably been in a store or something. So he was targeted, right? And then the next picture is the kid is lying in a pool of blood. That's Life magazine. So, you know, that was, I can't remember exactly what month Newark was, but that was 1967. So by then I'm 14. I'm looking at these 14-year-old boys who are being shot down because precisely for that reason, they had taken a television or something like that. And what you're saying, Dr. Bonner, when the police were restrained, or in the case of Washington, if they were restrained, that had a decelerating instead of an accelerating impact on what was going on. But usually the cops do just the opposite.
Exactly. But the way that the D.C. mayor expressed it, you're looking at a life versus a material thing. And so we can't really go back to August, as I do in my mind every August, but you can't go back to Watts without seeing a connection to today. We are still seeing people who are, as far as we can tell, more often black and young and male, who are being subjected to the same kind of thing, not only by police, but in today's climate, by civilians who feel somehow freed to do that.
Stand your ground.
Yes, exactly. In Florida, a man, you know, could have been a fist fight, but a man who's trying to defend his family shoves a guy who's giving them a hard time about a parking spot, and he ends up dead. That's execution on the spot.
And the shooter, not arrested. A white man shooting a black man who's unarmed, who had been in the store in Clearwater, Florida, buying candy for his 5-year-old and 3-year-old kids, comes out. The other guy is ranting against his wife in the car. He pushes him down, and the guy pulls a gun out, shoots him, and guess what? No problem.
Mm-hmm. Which makes me think then, that we really haven't made that much progress in 50 years or in 60 years.
We haven't, and that comes to this year's, brings us to this year's National Urban League, their periodic check on what is the difference between being black in this country and white. And of course, more and more Americans every day are neither or classified as neither. But we have still that dichotomy. So the Urban League found that in terms of equality, and they always focus on economic first, injustice and inequality, that in terms of getting their share of, quote, the American pie, which is a shorthand for reaching the same level within the, within one ethnic group as compared to the other, that African Americans now stand at about 72% of the 100% if you compare the two groups of an opportunity in financial gains and in the economy, et cetera. And so it's the root of it is that you don't have the same status of living. You don't have the same opportunities. You don't have the same image in the media. And the media play a really important role in all of this, the news media in particular. And so we're still looking at something that has to be addressed on the topic that Dr. King, of course, died in preparation for bringing to the fore, and that's economic injustice.
That's the voice of Dr. Alice Bonner. We talked to Dr. Bonner periodically in an ongoing series about important episodes in the history of Black America, which, of course, is the history of America. And we're talking right now about the anniversary of the 1965 Watts, I don't know, you could call it a rebellion, you could call it a revolt, you could call it an insurrection. In the media, it was just described as a riot, as if people had lost their minds.
Which is a criminal action.
Yeah.
A riot is a criminal action.
Yeah.
Rather than a social movement.
Exactly. And even if there's crime involved in it, which of course there was in Watts, and there are in all of these urban rebellions, it would not be happening. It's not happening because people want to, quote, steal a TV. It's happening because this smoldering, subterranean, pent-up frustration about oppression and inequality, as you're describing it. And these patterns replicate. And white America largely doesn't understand. They don't know about it. They have only a, you know, a tangential connection to Black America. They get their images from caricatured, stereotypical images from the corporate-owned media that seem to validate racist caricaturing. But the fact of the matter is, as and I think, Dr. Bonner, you're correct, and I think it's important to go back to the economic underpinnings of the disparity. When you look at what happened in the 2007-2008 Great Recession, a lot of people, black, white, Latino, you name it, they lost their homes, they went into foreclosure, they lost their jobs. But for black America lost more than 50% of its aggregated existing wealth, because a lot of the minimal wealth that was tied up in the black community was tied up in household assets, and that's what got liquidated.
Exactly.
It's a really important point that, again, most white people don't actually understand how this ongoing, enduring disparity continues. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that that also lopsidedly through the suffering as a result of that phenomenon more to females, because women heads of household who'd struggled to get good jobs, to get a mortgage, who had been misled by the slogan that your wealth is in your home, and had taken these faulty loans. So when you say that race was a heavier factor, the next statement has got to be that that meant that gender was also more significant in that development. But again, I come back to Watts is still with us. Anybody who doesn't see the line between Watts 65 and Charlottesville 2017 is not paying much attention. And so we see that there is still a good deal of anger. But the aftermath of Watts was backlash because of the criminal element. Now, keep in mind that the nonviolent civil rights movement was also criminal. Rosa Parks broke a law. Was that law constitutional? I don't think anybody would argue that it wasn't a law that needed to be broken. But again, it's looked at in a very different way, and we still live with it. The embers of Watts are still smoldering, as you said, John.
Yes, we're speaking with Dr. Ellis Bonner. You know, I worked, Dr. Bonner, with Ramsey Clark for about 30 years, starting in 1989, and still work with him. He's a good, dear friend, now about 90 years old. But Ramsey Clark was a very, very young assistant attorney general. He became attorney general in 1967, but he was assistant attorney general in 1965, and he was sent by the Justice Department to Watts. And he became a principal author of the report about Watts. I've spoken with Ramsey a great deal about this. He was in his early 30s. That's how young those guys were at the time. About the profound impact that the Watts revolt had on him and on government, and a recognition that unless the government did something to remedy or bring relief, especially on the economic front for Black America, formal civil rights by itself wasn't going to do the trick. The government had to do something. And so we had the war on poverty. We also had the beginning of just shortly thereafter of affirmative action programs. It was only in response to these rebellions in the Black community, which had, again, been demonized and caricatured, but that was the only thing that made the government actually do something on the economic front.
It did, and Lyndon Johnson had the right idea, but unfortunately he had inherited another idea, which we call Vietnam. And he was so saddled with trying to do those two perhaps equally impossible tasks, not lose a war, as he termed it, and do something about the domestic front, again, drawing somewhat on his assassinated predecessor's bills. Lyndon Johnson sought to do the impossible, and that was to prosecute this war and do something about the war at home. And the people who were lighting matches in the ghettos at the time and subsequently in Detroit and Newark and other places were fully aware of this. In that period, it was said, it changed afterward, that the preponderance of fatalities in Vietnam were young Black men because of the exemptions that were given to those who could afford to go to college. And so they felt that inequality so deeply that they didn't feel there was any other way out for them. But when the cinders, as you described them, began to flame, then this was something that you could do in the immediate. You could get attention. And again, television news was new, but television news was the instrument for getting attention. And the media, I have to say, was overwhelmingly white. When I did my research, my academic research, it focused on the fact that the news media, mostly newspapers in those days still, had covered everybody else's faults in keeping America segregated. They had not yet fully turned, and they still haven't effectively turned to the spotlight on their own institutions. They're still at it, but it's changed so much now because we have a much more multicultural and multi-ethnic America to be represented.
Yes, we do. We have 1 minute left. We're talking to Ellis Bonner. Dr. Ellis Bonner is a volunteer docent at the newly opened National Museum of African American History and Culture. We have 1 minute left, Dr. Bonner. Watts was a turning point, and yet here we are, as we've discussed, so much has remained the same. And so there's undoubtedly frustration with it. Dr. King, you were alluding to Dr. King before. 2 years later, he said about Johnson's war in Vietnam, you can't have a war in Vietnam and also a war against poverty at home. And he also said, I can't tell young kids in Watts not to rebel and be, quote, violent when our government, my government, is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. We have 30 seconds left. When you just think about how salient those words are for us today, 30 seconds left.
What's changed is also important. And Mark Morial, who's the head of the National Urban League, focused in his report this year on the technological change. Until you have the people of color in this country as well represented in the jobs in those industries, those new 21st century institutions, you're going to have still that disparity. And they haven't even begun to be employed at the level that they are users and supporters of those industries as
we're gonna discuss that issue, the impasse or the need to overcome the impasse on technological inequality in another segment. We've been joined by Dr. Alice Bonner. She was here in our studio. She is the volunteer docent in the newly opened National Museum of African American History and Culture, a retired professor at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland, and a longtime journalist at the Washington Post. She helps us understand the big key episodes, or some of them, in Black American history, in American history. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. It's Friday, so again today we look at political races around the country in the run-up to midterm elections in November. We're joined from Washington by Jackie Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their very, very interesting live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Jackie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Jackie, again, this week, so much has happened. There were critical primaries held in places like Missouri and Kansas and Ohio and Michigan. What was the most interesting thing for you this week?
The most interesting thing for me, other than everything that happened that I just did not have time to catch up on and just so much activity, the most interesting thing for me was actually the Ferguson prosecutor's race.
Right.
I heard about that, and that excited me more than anything else, because here is a guy, Wesley Bell, came out of nowhere and defeated Bob McCullough. If you remember Bob McCullough from mm-hmm. the Mike Brown trial, the just notorious prosecutor in St. Louis County, has been the prosecutor in St. Louis County for 20 years, I think, for several decades. And due to the grassroots efforts of Democracy for America, who backed Wesley Bell and did exactly what we say every week Democrats have to do, to get out into the communities, knock on doors, talk to people, Wesley Bell served Bob McCullough his pink slip. It's fabulous, just fabulous.
You know, and we saw the same thing happen, 2 years ago in Florida after the Trayvon Martin killing. That prosecutor
right.
lost. We saw Joe Arpaio go down 2 years ago mm-hmm. and actually mm-hmm. came in third and is even polling worse now in his ill-fated Senate race than he did 2 years ago. So, yeah, you know, it's as though it's payback time for a lot of these guys who were just wrong on the issues, and now it's their turn.
Absolutely. And this is also a great testament to the importance that voting still has.
Oh,
even,
yeah.
Even disappointed and disaffected as a lot of people might feel about the voting process, when you look at races like this prosecutor race in St. Louis County, there's no way you can come away from looking at that not believing that voting in many elections on the local level, these down ballot races, they do count. They matter to the people who live in these communities. So I am always going to be one who champions not only voter mobilization, but voter and political education to get these kinds of results for people.
Let me stress that. You know, I remember when I was a kid reading that turnout in the 1960 presidential election was so critical that if John Kennedy had lost just one vote in each precinct in America, he would have lost the election. That's mm-hmm. one vote in each mm-hmm. precinct. In 1974, there was a Senate race in New Hampshire between John Durkin. Oh, shoot, I forget who the Republican was. Anyway, that Senate race ended in a tie. Now, we're talking about nearly a half a million votes cast, and it ended in a tie, and they had to have a revote. So, my gosh, if there's anything as important as voter turnout and voter education, I don't know what it is. Now, we're crowing about these important races that were decided on Tuesday. And in fact, overall voter turnout was something like 23%. We should be ashamed of ourselves as Americans for having voter turnout of 23%. But that's what it is.
I absolutely agree. Yeah. I mean, that is, I think, now that is the testament to the disaffection people feel with the system. The fact that people feel like their vote doesn't matter. And that is the fault of both political parties and every politician who has been involved with them for the past five decades.
You're absolutely
there's
right.
There's no other way to look at that.
You're right. The system is flawed. The system is corrupt. I want to talk about a couple of these other races. I think besides the race you just cited, the prosecutor in Ferguson, Missouri, another really critical race was the Republican gubernatorial primary in Kansas, where you've got an incumbent Republican governor, Governor Collier, running against a firebrand right-wing conservative secretary of state, and that's Kris Kobach.
Mm-hmm.
The day before the election, Donald Trump came out and violated Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment, thou shalt not speak ill of another Republican, and thou shalt not run against another Republican, and Trump endorsed Kobach over Collier. That is absolutely unheard of. But he did it.
Yeah.
And as things stand now, Kobach is ahead by 115 votes. So what do you make of that?
I mean, again, you want to talk about the importance of voting? We're talking about 115 votes deciding who's going to be the governor of Kansas between, I love that you use the word firebrand because that's very polite. Kobach is... he's a monster.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, he's a complete extremist.
He is a monster. He was corrupt isn't even the right word, but he was the person in charge of the whole voter fraud commission, where he demanded that states turn over their voter records to the commission to look for voter fraud, and there were legal battles involved in that, and he's been charged with contempt of court. And he passed the legal bills off to the residents of Kansas. Just the fact that people are supportive of someone who would do that pretty much, I think, lets us know what kind of people are in the Trump base. We're not talking about people who are all of that. Who value the concept of democracy. Not at all. They are people who value power.
Oh, yeah. And speaking of not respecting the concept of democracy, as Secretary of State, Kobach is in charge of counting the votes.
Right.
And so what the governor is accusing him of doing is that he's giving improper and perhaps illegal instructions to the counties, the individual counties in Kansas, and he's violating Kansas law in terms of how votes are counted and how ballots are secured. So he's filed a federal suit against his primary opponent, Kobach, and we have to wait and see how it works out. But this has to be one of the closest and most important races in the country for the Republicans right now. One of the reasons it's so important, too, is that for the first time in more than a generation, if Kobach wins, it actually gives the Democrats a chance to pick up that governor's house. There hasn't been a Democratic governor in Kansas since the early 1990s, perhaps?
Yeah, it's been about 30 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been about 30 years. The interesting thing about whomever runs against whichever one of these people, the Democrats have to pick their strategy. You would think that the strategy against Kobach, if he wins, would be easy with all of this corruption and malfeasance and you know, clear disregard for the law. It's interesting coming from people who are so focused on law and order until breaking the law or bending the rules benefits them. But again, that's not going to work as a negative against people who support that kind of thing. The easier candidate, if we want to frame it that way, for the Democrat would actually be Coimer. Because
why do you say that?
Is because he's carrying Brownback's albatross of those horrendous tax cuts.
That's a good point.
Easy target right there, because nobody in Kansas, not even the Republicans, like what Brownback did.
That's a good point, because you know what? They have the lowest paid teachers in America. They're ranked 50th in education, in public education. And in fact, they have more teachers who are leaving the state and going to neighboring states to teach than they are able to hire teachers to come into Kansas.
Yes. Yes. I mean, so I think the Democrats can pick up this seat. I do think, though, that because we're dealing with a Trump base that they're intransigent. They are really just, you can't reason with some of these people when they really are going to vote for someone who actually is violating law and violating ethics, voting ethics rules. There's no appealing to them on anything. So I think that Kobach would actually be the tougher race. The Democrats could win it, but it won't be easy.
Oh, that's very interesting. I want to switch to news that broke today, Friday, about West Virginia. You know, you and I talk about the West Virginia Senate race all the time. This has nothing to do with the Senate race.
Okay.
Although we can talk about that, too, because the latest polls show that nobody can beat Joe Manchin. But there was a piece in today's Washington Post that says that the entire Supreme Court of the state of West Virginia is in the process of being impeached.
Wow.
The entire Supreme Court. And why are they being impeached? Because each one of them has an historic desk, a hand-carved desk that was designed and made by the architect of the state capitol, who also happens to be the architect of the U.S. Supreme Court. And what did they do? They stole the desks and took them home.
Oh, no.
Well, the desks are worth $42,000 each. And as it turned out, when investigators began to look at the missing desks, they found out that a whole bunch of furniture was missing, and that furniture ended up being in all of these Supreme Court justices' homes. And so 14 separate articles of impeachment have been drawn up. The articles of impeachment include alleged corruption, maladministration, incompetence, neglect of duty, and criminal behavior. And they're going this week to the State House of Delegates. They are expected to vote yes on the impeachment, and then every one of the state Supreme Court justices will go on trial in the West Virginia State Senate. What do you make of that? You know, on the one hand, I say, well, of course, it's West Virginia. On the other hand, it's also 2018, and you have to be an utter moron to just steal your office furniture and think you're going to get away with it. What do you make of this?
I don't think I could say it better than that. I mean, I'm sitting outside of my office right now on a little lovely little patio that we have at the building, and there's some lovely chairs. I could not make it out of this building with any of these chairs. I don't even know how these people did this. I don't understand how you are a Supreme Court justice for your state, and somehow you think it's a good idea to back a U-Haul up to the courthouse and load the furniture from your office into it.
One funny postscript to this is there are 10 members of the Supreme Court that are being charged. The Supreme Court actually has 11 members in West Virginia, and the 11th was the Chief Justice, Menace E. Ketchum II, a Democrat. Now, normally he would preside over the Senate's trial, but unfortunately, he can't do that because he was just arrested on federal wire fraud charges.
What?
And he just decided to plead guilty. So that's West Virginia.
West Virginia is a special place.
It's really, you know, I'm from Pennsylvania. We like to say Pennsylvania is the most corrupt state in America. And no, it's not.
No, it really is not.
No, West Virginia is. To wrap up West Virginia, that Joe Manchin Senate race, Manchin is running against the state attorney general. His name is Patrick Morrisey. Morrisey was, on paper, the strongest Republican that could possibly have been nominated to challenge Joe Manchin. Now, remember, Manchin's a former two-term governor. He's a two-term senator. He's very popular, and he's a Democrat, even though West Virginia has become a very, very heavily Republican state. And indeed, Donald Trump got 68% in West Virginia in 2016. But as things stand now, Joe Manchin is ahead in the polls between 9 and 12 percentage points. Morrisey has $900,000 in the bank that he can spend between now and November. Manchin has $6.2 million in the bank that he can spend on advertising between now and November. And it looks like Morrissey's ready to throw in the towel. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, he should. He should. All he can do now is put up a brave face and you know, declare that he fought the good fight, that there is no way he's going to win this race.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, frankly, if I were a Republican National Committeeman, I would turn my attention to other states like Missouri, for example, or Indiana or Florida, because they're just not going to win that race in West Virginia.
No.
So I wanted to, we only have 9 minutes left, which I can't even believe, but the sound engineer just warned me that we're already running short on time. So I want to talk about a couple of other things. There was a congressional primary in Michigan that is absolutely fascinating, and it's of national import. And it's because the Democratic primary in a very heavily Democratic district in Dearborn, or that centers around Dearborn, was won by Rashida Tlaib. Now, Rashida Tlaib is a very young, very energetic Muslim woman, and she would be the first Muslim woman ever elected to Congress. She's getting a lot of really great press right now, and her message is actually very, very solid. And it is one of bringing people together, working across party lines. She's not an extremist on any issue. She's sort of a down the road person who, you know, what can I say? She has brought people together in previous positions in politics, and she says that's what she wants to do in the Congress once she's elected.
Yeah, I think her win is really great. For people who don't know what the Dearborn, Detroit community is like, Dearborn is pretty much right outside of Detroit proper, and it's surrounded by Southfield and some other kind of demographically mixed communities. But there is a large Arab population in Dearborn, and in the outside community, in the communities outside, you've got Detroit and, you know, Southfield and other places that have a very large African-American electorate. And and it had always been believed that there was this, like, antipathy between the Arab community and the African-American community surrounding Dearborn. But Rashida Tlaib winning in this race disproves that. Because she had a great deal of support from African-American voters in the area. So, and as you said, her record does reflect that she has worked very well with people across the board, and that is great. So nationally, if the Democrats want to really play up the big tent nature of their party, which is what they claim they are, they should take a few pointers from her and really, again, continue to do outreach, or not continue, but really step up their efforts to do outreach in the communities that are their most loyal base, and that's the African-American communities and other marginalized groups of people.
You know, that is good politics right there, and that is exactly what people should be doing. And it's funny because it seems like such an obvious formula for success, and yet it's not duplicated a lot of times in other districts. We saw it happen in Queens with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She reached across racial and ethnic and even political lines and won an upset race. We saw it now with Rashida Tlaib, and it works. It works, and I think it's going to be copied elsewhere around the country. So let me move on to another thing, too. And this is kind of in the what the heck are you talking about category. We all know Michael Avenatti as the attorney for Stormy Daniels, the adult film star, porn star, who had an affair apparently with Donald Trump. Well, Michael Avenatti is one of those guys that Republicans love to hate because he's out there on all the networks screaming and shouting and yelling about Donald Trump. And he decided that he wants to run for president. And so this week he traveled to Iowa for the first time to begin a presidential exploratory trip. Now, Politico says, Politico quotes him. This is such a great quote. He says, "I'm exploring a run for the presidency of the United States, and I wanted to come to Iowa and listen to people and learn about some issues that are facing the citizens of Iowa, and I want to do my homework." Okay. So there he is. It says he's scheduled to speak Friday night, that's tonight, at the Democratic Wingding fundraiser in Clear Lake, an event that hosted Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in 2015 and Barack Obama in 2007. He's accompanied by a Democratic strategist who's a veteran of the Clinton 2016 campaign. And he told the New York Times that within the next month, he is going to visit New Hampshire. I don't know if the guy is going to be taken seriously. I doubt it. I have no idea if he can raise money. I doubt it. But do you think this is any more than a one-day story?
I am hoping it's no more than a one-day story, as amusing as it is. But I'm hoping it's more. It's not any more than a one-day story for the Democrats, because this is not a good look for them. As funny as this is, for the Democrats, for any Democratic strategist worth their credentials to be seriously working with this guy to explore a run for the presidency is just, it just lends kind of the circus atmosphere to the Democratic Party that they have lambasted, that they say existed with Donald Trump's run. This is just silly.
Yeah, I agree. It's great for entertainment, but it ends there. 2 minutes left, Jackie. The last thing I want to talk about is Nancy Pelosi. The Washington Post reported today that while Democrats are optimistic that they will win back control of the House, we've talked about that on this show many times, a lot of new politicians, a lot of new Democratic winners or Democratic nominees who believe they will win their races are refusing to endorse Nancy Pelosi as Democratic leader or Speaker of the House. That number is up to 27 people. And the most recent is Rashida Tlaib. She, it says here, became the latest, the 27th Democratic House candidate to decline to say whether or not she would support Nancy Pelosi. Some Democrats fear that anti-Pelosi attacks aimed at the Democratic candidates in this week's special election in Ohio and elsewhere helped push the Republican to a narrow lead. So is it time for Nancy Pelosi to step down, to go away? And do you think she does more harm than good for Democratic candidates?
Oh, it's been long overdue time for Pelosi and Feinstein and Hoyer and all of them, all of the old guard, to step down and go away. But they're too entrenched in power, and they're not going to. And that is going to pose a problem for the Democrats governing down the road, even if they take back the House, which they probably will. The point that these new and emerging Democratic politicians are making is that it's not enough to just win. You have to govern. You have to implement policy for people. I mean, what happened in Missouri with voters striking down the right to work legislation is a key indication that people are not seeing the kind of advocacy for their issues.
So true.
From their politicians that they are expecting. So they're just doing it themselves.
So true.
So, yeah, Pelosi should step down, but she's not going to.
No, she's not going to.
It's going to be a fight to the end.
It is, and it's going to be ugly. With that, we are out of time. We were joined from Washington by Jackie Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief with her husband Abdus of Lukman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 on Facebook. We'll have a lot more on politics coming soon. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.